be wise to put a limit on live gifts. That's just for the benefit of our staff, because I know one staff member would love to donate a horse, but I got a couple of sons who want to donate a cat, so it may be a good idea to just set a rule that eats, we don't want it. So, otherwise, I can anticipate a lot of problems over there at the Stewart residence. So, I also want to thank you for the birthday gift and the birthday cards. That was really very touching, and I very much appreciate that. And I got a card in the mail from someone who donates to our ministry, and it really makes me wonder whether I was wrong to adopt an old earth creationist view. This is how the card reads. It's got this nice astronomical image in front, and it says, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth." And you open it up, and it says, "So, tell me, what was it like?" So. Well, I'm going to share a couple of scientific discoveries today. Usually I just stick it to one, but these are actually relevant to what we're studying in the book of Job. And one is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and it pertains to an interesting study on anthropology. And, Fuzrana and myself are going to be sticking this in our new book on human origins. Our editors are still letting us slip in new stuff, even though the book is written. But this is really quite exciting in the sense that a group of researchers have looked at the teeth of bipedal primates stretching from about 5 million years ago, the Australopithecines, through Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and finally human beings. And what they're looking at, they've looked at teeth for a long time. That teeth is kind of one of the ways they can determine what specimen falls into what species. But these researchers decide to look at tooth wear. And what they were trying to determine was the demographics of the population of each species. In particular, they were trying to determine what's the ratio of old specimens to young specimens. I mean old in terms of the age of the individual. And what they noticed was something quite startling and quite unexpected, that the ratio of they kind of broke it into, ignored the children and just focused on what they called young adults. And young adults would be those individuals that were just past puberty. And that's different for different species. One of the things we do know about the different bipedal primates is that the human species moves into puberty at the oldest age of all the specimens. Neanderthal, for example, they go through puberty, 5 to 6, even 8 years behind human beings. So we reach puberty later than any other species of bipedal primates. But then they looked at those adults, so it would be a few years past that, compared to what they called old adults, which is anybody beyond, that time. And what they discovered is that all except for the human species, you see a ratio of one old adult for 3 young adults. So it's a 1-to-3 ratio. And again, the way they classified the young adults is quite young, maybe you take the age up to puberty and you multiply that by 1.5, and that's the limit of the young adults. And then they looked at everything else as an old adult. So in this class, almost all of us would be classified as old adults. So I can see 2 or 3 exceptions, but only 2 or 3. But that's the thing they noticed. When you look at the human species, they decided here not to look at human beings today because, the human population, as you're well aware, has aged considerably over the past 50 years. What they looked at is what are called Paleolithic humans. These are humans that were living like 10, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago. So these would be the early history of the human species. And what they observe there is that they see at least 2 old adults for every young adult. Well, you can do the math. What that tells you is that on a per capita basis, there's 6 times as many old adults in the population for humans as there would be for the Neanderthals. And the Neanderthals are the most aged of these populations. So it's a 6-to-1 ratio. And what's particularly interesting about this includes the overlap between the Neanderthal population and the first humans. So here you've got two species living at the same time, and one species has 6 times as many old adults as the other species per capita. Now, the conclusions that the researchers drew from this really weren't getting into the theological issues. They were just simply noting that this explains why the human species is so advanced compared to the Neanderthals. In other words, they noticed that the Neanderthal brain's about the same size as our brain, although the Neanderthal brain is smaller than our brain on a per weight basis. In other words, we have the largest brain to body mass ratio. But what they're trying to do in this article is attribute the advanced nature of the human species to the fact that ours is a species that has people live a lot older. And because we live a lot older, that means that an individual can achieve more creativity in the course of his lifespan and pass it on to the next generation. And I would grant that's certainly a lot to do with it, but it doesn't explain why the human species is so much more accomplished and advanced than, say, the Neanderthals. But I think the main point that was missed here is, how is it that you've got this one species of bipedal primates that has such a longer lifespan than all the other species of bipedal primates? You know, what is it about us that gives us this? And it's something we've talked about in the class before, that in terms of the large animals on planet Earth, our human species experiences about 4 times as many heartbeats as any other competing large animal species on this planet. So it seems like we really are specially created. This is evidence, I think, in support of the point we're making in this book, that we humans are uniquely created in the image of God. There's something unique and special about the human species. And I think this is one more piece of evidence that one of the factors that makes us unique and special is the fact that we have the capacity to live such long lives. And we also have a societal structure whereby the individuals in the species think it's valuable to preserve old people. They are the ones that have the treasure of wisdom and knowledge, and that can pass on to the next generation what's going on, and we tend to value that, whereas other species do not. And I think that's a sign of the fact that, we are different, we are spiritual. God has granted us this capability of intelligence and creativity. But a factor of 6 is huge, and we see this as really significant evidence that, indeed, the human species can't be evolved. It must be specially created. How can you explain this factor of 6 any other way? Now, a discovery that really pertains to what we're studying here in Job 37, 38, and 39. Now, this, by the way, on the human thing that was in the latest issue, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This one is in the latest issue of Nature. And I don't know how often you get hit with this, but this happens to me when I speak at university campuses a lot. Someone in the audience, some skeptic, will come up to the microphone and say, well, how do you explain parasites? How do you explain carnivores? But the real issue is parasites. Or another question I get a lot is, if God is all-powerful and all-loving, why did he create mosquitoes that spread West Nile virus? Okay, that's kind of a new twist on that theme. But one I get a lot is, why would a good God create flies? But kind of the theme here is, why would a good and loving God create parasites? Well, there's an article here in the latest issue of Nature that explains why a good and loving God would create parasites, why he would create carnivores, and why he would create actually several kinds of parasites. In fact, what I've noticed in reading this article is good evidence for why a good God would want to create lots of parasites. So next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, a new theme to thank God for, okay? All right, I'm just kidding. All right. But this is a story that goes back to 1868. And it's Leopold Trouvelot. And he's an anatomy professor at Harvard University, a famous scientist of his day. But he wound up ending his life in infamy because of a little experiment he was doing. And like a lot of scientists of that day, he was paid to do anatomy research. But in his spare time, he would dabble in another discipline of science. It was quite common back in the 19th century because scientists just loved to play in different fields. And his amateur scientific hobby was entomology, you know, the study of insects. And so he was doing experiments on insects in his home in a Boston suburb. And one of the things he was interested in was doing experiments on European moths. But there was an accident in his home, and a couple of the moths got loose. And those moths are the famous gypsy moth. And so he was the one that was responsible for introducing the gypsy moth into North and South America. Until that time, there were no gypsy moths in North and South America. And, you know, for what it's worth, that's one response you can throw out to why would a good and loving God create mosquitoes that would spread West Nile virus. Well, you know, God didn't put West Nile virus here in North America. Human beings put West Nile virus here in North America. And, you know, back before the white man came, mosquitoes were limited to the Arctic and to the very southern tip of South America and to, you know, parts of the jungles. We were the ones that spread mosquitoes over the whole of North and South America. In fact, before human beings were created, mosquitoes were limited to 10% of the geographical land area of the planet. And in that 10%, they serve a very good role in controlling the ecology. For example, in the Canadian Arctic, mosquitoes are the only creatures that eat the dung of lemming. And you know, there's a lot of lemming up there. And so you need a lot of mosquitoes to take care of that. And then the mosquitoes would bite the lemming for their blood, and, you know, that's fine. The lemmings were quite well adapted to giving a little bit of blood to the mosquitoes. And actually the disease that was spread through the mosquitoes helped control the lemming population, which is kind of what this article is all about in terms of the gypsy moth. So you could actually build a theme for why God would want to have mosquitoes that would spread disease up in the Canadian Arctic. But the whole point is it wasn't his intent there'd be mosquitoes here in Southern California or West Nile virus here in Southern California. That was really man's mismanagement of the planet that introduced those problems here to Southern California. So don't blame God for the mosquitoes in Southern California or the West Nile virus. That's our fault, not God's fault. And mosquitoes really do serve a good purpose for where they exist. But back to the gypsy moth. These gypsy moths, only a couple of them were released, but they very slowly began to multiply, and then by the end of the 19th century, they had become epidemic. And so the situation, particularly in the eastern United States, is every few years you get a gypsy moth epidemic. And what happens is the gypsy moths multiply literally up into the billions, and they begin to swarm through the forests of eastern U.S., and they just strip the trees bare of leaves. And then when they do that, the forests begin to die. And when that happens, the gypsy moths starve to death. And so they go back down to a low population. Then they build up again. And several years later, you got another epidemic. Okay. This particular study is saying we're now beginning to bring the gypsy moth under control. And what these scientists did is they studied what's happening to the changing dynamics of gypsy moth populations. Because what they've been observing is that the gypsy moth population would go way up, catastrophically drop down, and then it would go way up again and catastrophically drop down. But in the last few decades, they've been noticing that the peaks from the high population to the low population have been gradually getting smaller and smaller. So they're trying to figure out why. And what they discover is that the gypsy moth does have control factors. And this is a discovery of four different control factors. An obvious one is that as the gypsy moth multiply out of control, you get a deteriorating quality and quantity of the foliage on the trees they feed on. And so the quality of the leaves, the food they make available for the gypsy moth just becomes more limited, and the quality of that food goes down. And that eventually brings the gypsy moth epidemic under control, but with devastating results. Because what you have are, say, birch forests that are completely cleaned off of leaves. They die, and the birch forests have to recover. And this is really bad for the gypsy moth. I mean, think if you're a gypsy moth, and you're part of this epidemic, and all the trees get stripped, the trees die. Well, for the next several years, you've got nothing to eat, and so you have all of this starvation of gypsy moths. It's really bad news to have this kind of epidemic. It's great while the epidemic's going, where you have all these nice leaves to eat, but you know the consequences are truly catastrophic for the gypsy moth. And of course, really catastrophic for the birch trees, and it's catastrophic for every other life form that's dependent on these forests, because you know the forests being wiped out, this disturbs the habitats of many other species. It really is a huge catastrophe. So that's one limiting factor we've been aware of, but now they're discovering that with the introduction of the gypsy moth, there really weren't any predators in North America that found gypsy moths tasty. But over the course of several decades, these gypsy moth populations got large enough where the predators started to take notice. And so over time, there did develop a predator population for these gypsy moths. But it took quite a bit of time for that predator population to get to the point where it could start to control these gypsy moth epidemics. But this paper makes the point that the predators by themselves cannot do an adequate job of bringing the gypsy population down to what they call an idealized level, where the forests are healthy, the gypsy moths are healthy, and the predators are healthy. And what they discover in this paper, and is really what's new, is they found two pathogens that really do bring this under control, and there's a brand new pathogen that they just discovered that they claim will eliminate the epidemics once and for all. The first pathogen they found, and it's been a relatively new pathogen, is a viral infection. And the last several epidemics were brought under control actually more rapidly by the viral infection than they were by the predators. And so, well, with some help from the viruses, the predators were able to make for a less catastrophic epidemic. But the new pathogen that's arisen is a fungal pathogen. And what they're noticing is the combination of the fungal pathogen, the viral pathogen, the predators, and the lowered quality and quantity of leaf foliage will eliminate these epidemics. So they said from now on we can look forward to the fact that we're not going to be hit with these gypsy moth epidemics like we've had in the past with their catastrophic ecological consequences. So I thought it's interesting in the context of what we're studying here in Job 38 that there really is a good purpose for all the carnivores that God creates. And most species of life that are not carnivores, in order to have their health maintained, need the benefit of more than just one species of a carnivore. So God creates many different species of carnivores with different capabilities of keeping that population under control. And this article is pointing out that carnivores by themselves are not adequate to sustain idealized, optimized populations of plants and animals and herbivores and carnivores. You do need the parasites. The parasites really do play a critical role in bringing things into balance. And in this case, you need more than one parasite. You need at least two parasites, or maybe others we haven't found yet. But this is kind of the theme we see here in Job, and we'll see it again in Psalms, that when God creates life, He creates life in such a way that it has this perfect, optimized balance between the herbivores, the carnivores, the plants, and the parasites. Everything is created in such a way as to guarantee the highest quality of life for all species of life. And if you don't have this balance, then you get these ecological catastrophes like these gypsy moth epidemics. And also a little warning here, there's a good idea not to tamper with what God has done. You know, God has set up these relationships and these species with one another. But we human beings have this tendency of moving species from one habitat to another habitat where they weren't meant to be, and upsetting the apple cart. But isn't it amazing how well God has designed our planet and life on the planet so that we do upset the apple cart? There are measures that God has placed in advance in terms of His created order to bring things into balance. So our mistakes are not utterly catastrophic, at least not yet. Book of Revelation hints that we may make some really big moves in the future, but we are recovering from the gypsy moth mistake of 1868. It's taken a century and a half. but in one sense it wouldn't have happened at all unless God had built in a lot of diversity in the predators and the pathogens, the parasites, so we could recover from this. Yes. Yeah, it's actually in the same issue. So that's correct. So yeah, that's actually, there's two articles. It's in Science, by the way, not Nature. This is the latest issue of Science, and it does make that point that you know, the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere through the burning of carbon fuels isn't having quite the devastating impact that was predicted by a number of environmentalists, because the ocean is soaking up about half of the carbon dioxide that we release. And you know, it's being soaked up by different microorganisms that are in the oceans. They do dominate the biomass of the planet, so it's not surprising that the you know, unicellular life forms in the ocean are having a huge impact on regulating that carbon dioxide. But the point they make is, although it's not as bad in terms of the greenhouse effect that we ordinarily would suffer from that extra carbon dioxide, it is making the oceans more acidic. And as the acidity of the ocean goes up, that is going to affect the ecological balance within the ocean, especially with the microorganisms. So this is kind of a new environmental danger to watch out for. I think it's just another warning that when man upsets the balance, there will be consequences. But it is interesting how God has built in ahead of time things to try to bring into check man's sin. Yes. Right, right. Well, I mean, the same article or the same issue is talking about the potential of what they call a methane Armageddon. And it actually pertains to the oil industry, that there are bacteria that feed on petroleum, and as they feed on petroleum, they convert it to methane. So there's all this methane that's building up, and a lot of that methane is built up under the ocean floor. And the concern they're raising is, you know, what would happen if that methane were to be released and ignited? And there's a lot of methane there. But one of the ways that we can deal with that is to pump more petroleum out of the ground. That takes away the food supply for the bacteria. So this could be an interesting issue for the 2004 election. You know, should we pump more petroleum out of the ground, or should we leave it there for the bacteria to convert into methane? I don't know. And maybe we want the methane. This makes an interesting issue, yes.
Flies aren't all that bad because the larval form maggots take care of garbage in time before the garbage.
That's right. I mean, you can contrast the evolutionary model with the creation model. The evolutionary model would say there will be bad species of life out there that really degrade the quality of life for the planet. The creation model would say God doesn't create junk. He doesn't create bad stuff. And what's going on here is, it looks bad from our perspective, but if you look at it from God's perspective, and particularly if you discount how humans have messed things up, then you'll see that this is something that indeed is very good rather than something that is bad. But this is one of the most common arguments I hear from skeptics of Christianity, at least educated skeptics of Christianity. They look throughout the realm of science and say, look at all these mistakes. Look at all these vestigial organs, and look at all these bad designs, and look at all these species that shouldn't be there because they're detrimental. Well, flies really do serve a good purpose. On the other hand, it's we human beings that made flies ubiquitous in all the continental land masses. Just like with mosquitoes, there weren't flies everywhere. Today, there are flies everywhere. Why? Because we spread them to everywhere. You know, we would carry maggot-infested food with us to places where God didn't intend the flies to live. So, you don't like flies, don't like ants in your home, you know, maybe you need to look in the mirror and see who's responsible for bringing them there. Okay. Yes.
I was wondering if
Well, this particular article of Science is just saying the acidity is going up. And, you know, the first effects we're going to see is it's going to impact certain acid-sensitive microorganisms in the ocean. And the problem with that is those are the same microorganisms that are responsible for absorbing a lot of this carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So one thing that could happen is the oceans become more acidic. The oceans will contribute less to the removal of carbon dioxide, and that's going to make the greenhouse effect more problematic. No, there's probably other effects. I mean, that's just the easy stuff. And that's kind of what the article is saying. It says this is the first evidence that we've had of this phenomena, and here's what we can see off the top in terms of easy-to-understand consequences of this increased acidity. But all you need to do is go to certain lakes here in North America where there's been severe acid increase, and you can see what those effects are. By the way, there are life forms that can live in highly acidic conditions, but they're not the kind of the life forms you like to swim in water with. So, yes. Well, I think that's a very good point, that we have to be cautious when we're reading our Bible here not to take an anthropomorphic perspective, to see it from our point of view rather than God's point of view, and to realize that we're looking at life forms. I mean, you know, I call biology complex science. It's not like astrophysics where things are simple and you can describe them with differential equations. In biology, things are horribly complex, and it always bothered me that someone like Stephen Gould would say, look at all these bad designs in nature. And every bad design that was on his list is something that was poorly understood in the realm of biology. Just to give one example, he pointed out, he said, the panda's thumb is a clumsy design. Look at this horribly crippled design in the panda's thumb. He was comparing the panda's thumb to the human thumb and thumbs of other creatures. But now the biological community looks at the panda's thumb as an evidence of exquisite design. It's beautifully designed for stripping the leaves off of bamboo. And that's what the panda eats. And that's the only thing that pandas eat is bamboo leaves. And so this is a beautifully adapted thumb for that purpose. It's true, it's not very good for typing. But the panda doesn't do a lot of typing, so it works quite well. But that's just an example. You know, be really cautious to point a finger of blame at God on something you don't understand. And isn't that the theme of what we're seeing in Job 38? And we're going to especially see it in Job 39. God keeps pointing out to these five men, you don't understand the half of what I've created, a 50th of what I've created, a 5,000th of what I've created. And he says, you think you got it all figured out. You really don't. Let me explain some things to you. And I think that exhortation applies to this very day. You know, highly educated biologists think they know the situation better than God does, and that's not the way it is. By the way, that's also true in the simple sciences. I keep running into physicists and astronomers that think they can figure out a better way to put physics together than God has done it. So it seems to be a common human problem that we all think we're a little bit smarter than God is. Yeah, Cliff.
I think I've read articles in the past where they claim that the human race is a parasite on the earth. And if you weren't here, it would be such a wonderful, nice place. That would be a bad.
So maybe
it's
the writer of the article.
Well, I mean, I see some merit in that statement that we human beings are the parasite of planet Earth. I mean, you go back to Genesis chapter 1, God gave us a mandate, manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life. But because we rebelled against God in the Garden of Eden, we've tended to have the opposite effect. And in one sense, I can see some legitimacy to labeling the human species as the greatest parasite on planet Earth, because just in the last 40,000 years, we've eliminated 10,000 bird species, 11,000 bird species from existence. You know, and that may not seem like very many, but there are only 20,000 to start with. So we've eliminated over half of all the bird species on planet Earth in an incredibly brief period of time, and we've done the same thing to the land mammals. And then we've brought mosquitoes into places where they weren't supposed to be. We've brought rats into places where they weren't supposed to be. So yeah, you can put a lot of blame on the human species. And the message we're going to see here in Job is that, you know, we're sinners. And because of our sin and our failure to listen to God's instructions, we do mess up. And because we're such powerful, predominant species, when we mess up, it has huge consequences for all the species of life. I mean, we ran into that. And then that even happens when we're trying to protect life. I mean, do you remember a couple of years ago where they were really concerned about the extinction of the kangaroo rat? And so they passed a law here in Southern California that said that homeowners were no longer going to be permitted to build a dirt trench around their home. That was a standard technique for protecting your home from being destroyed by a forest fire or a grass fire. You just clear all the brush up. They said, no, that brush is the habitat for this kangaroo rat that's in danger of going extinct. And so, you know, this is a good move to try to protect the kangaroo rat from extinction. But it was kind of wrong-headed because the next forest fire that went through that area burned down all those homes, burned down the habitat of the kangaroo rat, and not only did we lose all these homes, we lost the kangaroo rats. They would have done a lot better if we had destroyed a part of their habitat. So that's just an example. Even when we try to do good, we mess up. So, and this is a theme you see throughout these creation texts, is that we humans have got to be really careful in trying to assess what's going on, because what God created is very complex. And if we don't understand the complexity of what God created, we can really mess up big time. Yeah.
Have you written anything or thought about what does the Bible say about how, as Christians, we should live? What should we be doing specifically to manage the resources properly?
Well, I mean, that would be a good thing to write. I don't have time to write that book. Maybe God's commissioning you to write that book. So I'm doing that more and more, by the way. And people tell me, Hugh, it'd be great for you to write a book on X. I'm saying, well, how about God's giving you this message. Maybe you can pull it off. So, but no, I would agree that that is a theme that we do see in Scripture, that you know, this is an area we really need to pay attention to, and we haven't been doing that great of a job on it. And, you know, again, we're going to see a bit of this as we get into Job 39 and 40 and 41. So, but the point I'm trying to make here in talking about this discovery is that, you know, maybe we need to have an environmental protection agency focusing on the preservation of parasites. I haven't seen them do too much in trying to make sure that we take good care of the parasites. You know, we look at that and say, you know, disease is bad. Let's just get rid of it all. But at least in the case of the gypsy moth, disease does serve a good purpose. We don't like it when it happens to us, but disease really does serve a good purpose. Even in our own species, I mean, God's in the business of trying to enhance the quality of life for all of us. And, you know, without some predation and parasitic control, our quality of life would go down as well. That may be a more difficult book to write. Might be hard to sell that book. So, okay, any more questions? Let's jump into the book of Job then. And what we're trying to do in Job 38 is finish up our discussion on the six creation days that are addressed here. I've given you a list in the past of how you can split up Job 38. And Job 38 is the first of three passages we're going to be looking at that reflect on Genesis chapter 1. And as many of you have pointed out, there's a lot more going on in Job 38 than just reflecting on Genesis chapter 1. God's got some specific instructions and exhortations to these five men that are going throughout here. Also addresses some apologetic issues, which we've taken some time to deal with. But if you haven't been apprised of this, we do have audio tapes of our previous messages. So last week we almost finished our discussion on Creation Day 5. There's only a short section on Creation Day 6. Let's see how far we can get. But Creation Day 5 is dealt with in verses 16 to 18 and verse 36, and Creation Day 6 runs from verse 36 to 41. And these are the passages that talk about God creating advanced animals. And these are animals with body, with mind, will, and emotion, as well as a body. Verse 16, "Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this." And what we discussed last time is just how God has created life on this planet, so it's in great abundance, in great diversity, everywhere you look on planet Earth. You know, we talked last week how you can find life 30,000 feet up in the atmosphere. You know, where you don't think anything can live, there is life up there. Even birds are flying at that altitude. And how God has designed the birds so that they can survive at that altitude for brief periods of time. We can't, unless we adapt for 40 or 50 days, but the birds are able to pull it off. And likewise, that we see insects at that altitude. In fact, you can go up to 105,000 feet above the surface of the earth, and you'll find microorganisms existing there. Likewise, you can go into the deep ocean. It says through the springs of the deep, the recesses of the deep. You know, until a century ago, the feeling of the biological community was that life was limited to the upper part of the ocean, because that's the part where the sun shines, where photosynthesis can take place. But in the 20th century, they discovered that there's life all the way down to the deepest depths of the ocean. And the idea that life could survive at those enormous pressures just seemed unfathomable 100 years ago. But today it's recognized that God has created really exotic life forms that can survive under those incredibly high pressure conditions at the bottom of the ocean. There's even life that can survive at these steam vents. And if you've been to Yellowstone National Park, you'll see that there's life surviving there where the water is boiling and you know, extremely acidic or extremely basic. There's bacteria that are making it there. And we talked last week about how scientists refer to these creatures as extremophiles, life that exists under extreme conditions. And even deep mines, they dug, you know, 2 miles down on the ground, gold mines and coal mines, and they find that 2 miles down in the crust of the earth, you can see bacterial life there. And how people have looked at this as a way to discount God, saying, well, since life exists under these extreme conditions, that means that life must be ubiquitous all over the universe, because wherever we see extreme conditions on Earth, we see life. But 2 points here. That those extremophiles cannot exist without the mesophiles. You know, say, how did that bacteria get down to those very deep levels, and how did it survive there? Well, they were able to follow cracks down that were created by other life forms, and those life forms provided a food supply, a chemical residue that seeps down in those deep areas that they can eat. And if it wasn't for the mesophiles, the life that exists under optimal conditions, then those extremophiles wouldn't have the capacity to survive. You know, and this is true of the deep ocean area too, that there's certain nutrients that are brought down to them from other life forms. And the second point we made is that extremophiles, life under extreme conditions, that's not a good situation for the origin of life. It's something we bring up in our Origins of Life book that's on the table here, is that the extremophiles offer no help for the origin of life. In fact, there's a paper we referenced that basically was titled "Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life," because it's easy to show that it's impossible for life to originate under those extreme conditions. You need life under good conditions first before you can support life under those extreme conditions. What we ended up last week, and we didn't get to finish this, is we noticed sandwiched between verse 16 and verse 18 is this interesting statement about death. Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? You know, and God's raising this question to these five men. He says, all of your debate so far for, you know, 37 chapters has been focused on stuff that's alive. Let me ask you a more challenging question. You think you understand how life lives. Tell me, what about the death part? Do you understand that? And basically the five men had to say, nope, we haven't got a clue about death. And so the issue we brought up last week is, you know, this is a question that troubles all people. You know, what is death like? And, you know, when I've talked to people that are terminal, they're always asking me a question, you know, as a pastor, saying, tell me, what is it like to die? And in the context of this chapter, these five men had to just shrug their shoulders and say, we haven't been there. We don't know what it's like. We have no experience of death. And in that sense, that's obvious, right? All of us are alive. And if you have the experience of death, you're no longer alive. So anyone who's alive has no experience of death. However, I think it takes us back to what we see in Genesis chapter 2, where God talked about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the problem for Adam and Eve is they felt that to have the knowledge of good and evil, they had to experience good and evil. I believe it was God's intent that Adam and Eve would learn about good and evil from his hand. He would instruct them. Their disobedience was, they said, you know, that's not good enough. We want to experience it. We want to see what it feels like. But likewise, we can go to this text and say, does the Bible actually give us any instruction about what it's like to die? And my point last week, it very definitely does. Yes. Yep, you're right. There's over 100 books on the market today on near-death experiences. Now, this isn't quite what this text is talking about. The question God is posing to these five men is, do you really know what it's like to pass through the shadow of death and get to the other side? Near-death experiences, if they're legitimate, and many of them are not, but if they are legitimate, is where you get to the entrance of the pathway to death and then you pull back. You don't actually go all the way through it and come back. And so that's just one caution on any book you might pick up of near-death experiences. Even if it's a legitimate anecdotal account, it's not someone who's gone all the way through and come back. It's someone who's gotten to the entrance and has popped back. That's not quite what this text is addressing. So I think it's still true that no one can claim to have had that experience other than the man Jesus Christ. He's been through that portal. You could also say Lazarus has been through that portal, but we don't have an account of what he told us about. So there are some real anecdotal points. But I do want to spend some time addressing near-death experiences, because I think it's a great opportunity for all of us. Anytime you're at a party, you can count on the fact that that subject has a good chance of coming up, okay? You know, especially here in Southern California, there's a good chance that will come up. And we need to be ready to take advantage of that. I'm not going to be able to do it today. I'm hoping to get to that next week, but I'll give you a rule of thumb. At least 90% of these near-death experience accounts are not legitimate experiences. And there's been studies done by non-Christian researchers who claim that they can explain it all with oxygen deprivation. That when the brain experiences severe oxygen deprivation, certain experiences are engendered by that, and that explains all the near-death experiences. That's an overstatement. It explains a lot of them. That doesn't explain all of them. And in terms of the ones that are not explained by natural phenomena, there is another category which I would call psychological inducement. The person's had this experience, and it's typically a person who has a low self-worth or a damaged self-image, and this is a way to get attention, and so they will tell this story. There are two other possibilities. The experience is satanically induced, or the experience really is a legitimate one from the Lord himself. And so the question is, how many of these near-death experiences fall into that fourth category? The answer is only a few. But they are there. And so we need not to just kind of jump in with the skepticism of our age and say it's all bogus. I'd be prepared to say a good percentage of it is bogus. A good percentage of it is fulfilling a psychological need. But there's a residual that is either satanic or demonically induced, or really is of the Lord. So those are the possibilities, which means you've got to be wise in looking at the stories. We're going to spend some time talking about that. But what I want to focus on in the time I've got remaining here, which isn't a lot, is to look at what the Bible says on this issue. And the text we looked at last week is one that's read at a lot of funerals. Table before me in the presence of my enemies. Oh, pardon me, verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And so this is a verse of encouragement to any Christian who is going through the gateway to death. What David is telling us here is that when you as a believer go through that gateway of death, you will not go through it alone. The Lord himself will escort you across that threshold. And as he escorts you across that threshold, he'll be there comforting you and encouraging you. It says his rod and his staff go with you. So the image here is of a shepherd guiding this wounded sheep along, and the shepherd is there to protect you and guide you through that shadow of death and comfort you each step of the way. So that should be enormously comforting to the believer. The other passage I want to take you to, I'm not going to go into a lot of discussion in Psalm 123, or 23, verse 4, because we did that last time. We do have a tape on that. But I wanted to spend some time on Psalm 139, verse 16. Your eyes saw my unformed body. And this is David speaking about his conception, how he was conceived in his mother's womb. So at that point, God saw him. And it's the same King David who made the point that he was a sinner in Psalm 51, verse 5, from the point of conception. So when do we become truly human? According to Psalm 139 and Psalm 51, we become truly human, which means physical, soulish, and spiritual at the point of conception. So this is where Christians get their scriptural support for the fact that abortions are equivalent to murder, because from the point of conception onwards, we're no longer just a physical piece of flesh. That's when God really joins his the inmost being of the human, the soul and the spirit, to the formed body. So he says, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And the whole point is we can take comfort again as believers in the fact that at the point that we were conceived, even before that, God had already put on his calendar the day that you had passed through that shadow of death. So that tunnel into the next world is on God's calendar for every one of us. Every one of us here in this room can take comfort in the fact that God did indeed ordain, according to Psalm 139, the very day, the hour, the minute we would cross that threshold. So the fact that it's on God's calendar in advance should be a source of comfort. Now, it doesn't mean that we can be reckless with our lives. I mean, it doesn't mean that this is a verse in support of suicide. And, of course, this brings up the whole issue of free will and predestination. If God indeed has predetermined my life, does that mean I'm free to eat all kinds of bad food and load up my bloodstream with cholesterol? No, that's not what this text is saying. And I think in one sense, there's every room to interpret this text and say, hey, you're at the threshold of death. I really expected you to live another 20 years. I gave you this great body. How come you didn't take good care of it? There will be room for that kind of umbrage there. But the whole point is, if you want to resolve free will and predestination, we're not going to do it in the last 2 minutes of this class. And I did write a book on this called Beyond the Cosmos. But the third point I would make, and this is what I'm probably going to do for next time, is make the point that throughout the Bible, we have stories. So it's not just these textbooks or books that are you can get in the stores, Christian and non-Christian stores, about near-death experiences. There are accounts here in the Bible of near-death experiences. There are accounts here in the Bible of people who did go through the threshold, the doorway of death, and told us what it was like. Probably the most detailed story of all is in the book of Acts. And I'll just take you quickly to that text. It's Acts chapter 8. And it's referring to Stephen going through this doorway of death. And by the way, people that were hearing his account weren't very pleased with what he had to say. But, it's obvious from the text here that he's giving a true account. And so Stephen gave a sermon. And what he said in this sermon, particularly, by the way, it was a very clever sermon. I'm not going to take the time to go through this. It goes on for a couple of pages. And what you notice in this sermon is that Stephen very cleverly, very wisely appeals to his audience, the Pharisees and the Sadducees who are opposing the spread of the Christian faith, and basically takes them through how the Old Testament and the Jewish styles of worship is fully supported and even strengthened by the ministry of Jesus Christ here on earth. But at the very end, he kind of nails the problem of the Jewish theological system at that time. namely that they were focused on works and not by the work that Christ would deliver on the cross to save them from their inability to live up to God's standard of perfection. And when they heard all that, he probably said something like, "You stiff-necked people with uncircumcised hearts and ears." This is a group of Pharisees and Sadducees that prided themselves in being the circumcised ones and the ones that were submitted to God. And basically, Stephen was saying, by your very behavior and your reaction to the one you crucified, you are not manifesting these characteristics. It says, "Was there ever a prophet your fathers did not persecute? They even killed those who predicted the coming of the righteous one. And now you have betrayed and murdered him. You have received the law that was put into effect through angels, but have not obeyed it." Now, I believe Stephen was inspired to say these things that inflamed his audience to the point where they killed him. And that's exactly what happened. They killed him. However, there were people in the audience that needed to hear that. And because of Stephen's willingness to lay down his life, there were people in the audience that received life in responding to the words he had to say and were delivered from this Jewish trap of thinking that they could fulfill the moral standard of God by their own good effort and their own attempt to live up to the law. And, you know, Stephen was saying that's impossible for any human to do, and without God's help, you're not going to make it. When they heard this, they were furious and gnashed their teeth at him. But Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, looked up to heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And then he said to the Sadducees and the Pharisees, "Look, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." Now, I'm not sure Stephen realized the significance of this. This is God calling him home. So the doorway was open, and now he's going to be the shepherd that was going to usher him across that threshold of death. What does it say in the following verse 57? "At this they covered their ears, and yelling at the top of their voices, they all rushed at him, dragged him out of the city, and began to stone him. Meanwhile, the witnesses laid their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul." And who was Saul? He was, Paul, yeah. But Saul here, his name became Paul, he was the leader of the Pharisees and the Sadducees that were persecuting to death the followers of this new sect of Jesus Christ. And it says, "While they were stoning him, Stephen prayed, 'Lord Jesus, receive my spirit.' Then he fell on his knees and cried out, 'Lord, do not hold this sin against them.' And when they had said this, he fell asleep," which means he had died. And Saul was there giving approval to his death. But Saul was also the one that heard the last two sentences out of Stephen's mouth at the end of the sermon. And he was the one recognizing this is a fellow that's being ushered across that threshold. So the whole point here, Jesus himself appeared to Stephen at the moment of his death, even before Stephen realized that he was going to be killed. They hadn't picked up any stones yet. So this is another point of encouragement. It's not just that God ushers you across the threshold of the death, the doorway to death and the doorway to the next life. He gives you a warning in advance. Now, one of the pastors here at this church has had about 40 years of experience in ministering to people that are at the point of death, Christians and non-Christians. And next week I want to share with you some of his accounts that he has given to me and others here in the church and what it's like. But the point is, if they're lucid, and this is the whole problem, most people are not lucid at the point of death. Stephen was a guy who was lucid and full grasp of all of his faculties, and he was able to hear what the Lord was saying, he was able to witness what the Lord is saying, and able to express that to his audience. Most people at the point of death can't do that. They're in a comatose state. They're dying of natural causes. Their body is decayed to such a point where we can't see, as observers on the outside, what's really going on. But I want to share you some stories that really do persuade me, at least, that God does speak to these people just before the point of death and lets them know it's going to happen soon, get ready, and even when they're in a comatose state. Because people that are in a comatose state, they are able to communicate, although with extreme limitation. And if you're apprised of that, you can see what's going on. But this is an example of a man who really was fully in charge of his faculties and noticed that God only ushered him across the threshold of death. He gave him a warning in advance of the first stone being thrown in his direction. wasn't easy to die a death of stoning. But God had given them a point of encouragement, saying, okay, this is your time. It's going to happen. It's going to happen real soon. But I'm going to be with you every step of the way. And I'm going to take you across this threshold, and there's going to be something really great that's going to come out of it. And of course, 13 books of the Bible were written by a witness to this event. And I don't think there would be a Paul. Saul would have stayed Saul if it wasn't for Stephen willing to give up his life in the manner that he did. Okay, I went 5 minutes over. Let me pray and I'll let you all go home. This is one of my favorite passages, is this act of Stephen. Father in heaven, I pray that each of us would take time just to look at these two chapters in the Bible where Stephen gives this magnificent sermon. And Lord, may we get some encouragement just by reading that sermon and getting some insights, Lord, on how we can personally minister to people that are self-righteous, people that think that they're ahead of the curve and they're on the good side of God. Father, may this give us some real wisdom on how we can talk in a loving, compassionate way to these people. And Lord, we thank you too that you've already told us in your word ahead of time what it is like to die. And Father, I pray you continue to bless our time as we study this doorway to death during the next week. Lord, just give us some rich time in your scriptures that we may be able not only take great encouragement ourselves as we approach the end of our lives, which is going to happen all too soon, but Father, that you'd be able to use us to minister to people that are likewise preparing to enter that doorway to death. In Jesus' name, amen.